Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Future generations may well have occasion to ask themselves, what were our parents thinking? Why didn't they wake up when they had a chance?
What do we owe future generations?
Are we morally responsible for the world that future generations inherit?
Is it possible to have obligations to people who don't even exist yet?
We have to hear that question from them now.
Every generation blames the one before.
If you can't help all those now in need around the world, what makes you think you can help future generations?
So let's all help keep Bigfoot possibly alive for future generations to enjoy unless he doesn't exist.
Our guest is Rahul Kumar from Queen's University.
What do we owe future generations?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. How much should we care about future generations?
Shouldn't we care as much about them as we do for ourselves?
Why not just live it up and let the people of the future sort it out?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
And today our conversation centers on, what do we owe to future generations?
That's like asking what we owe Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy. They don't exist.
Oh, Josh, future generations don't exist yet, I'll grant you that, but they will eventually.
Isn't it up to us whether they exist or not?
Oh, God, Josh, like, what, you think we're going to just someday collectively up and decide no more people to come? That would be a disaster.
I'm not advocating human extinction.
Oh, I'm glad of that, Josh. I'm really glad.
I'm just making a logical point. The logical point is this. Look, if we don't owe it to future generations even to bring them into existence, how can we owe them anything at all?
Well, because choices have consequences, Mr. Logic. Look, I'm going to grant you, maybe my parents didn't precisely owe it to me to bring me into existence. But, you know, once they decided they were eventually going to have a kid, they weren't just free to squander all their resources anymore.
But exactly how much of the resources should they have saved up for you? I mean, maybe they were right not to buy a yacht or something, but what if they took evening classes or went to the theater? You know, things that contributed to their happiness and flourishing. Would you retrospectively begrudge them that?
Well, it depends. I might well if their profligacy had made the future me permanently worse off. You bet I would. And look, if we don't take care of the planet now, future generations that will someday inherit this thing will definitely have the right to look back at us and say, we're pissed off at you, past people.
But what if fear of future righteous anger like that had caused your parents not to have a child at all? Would you like that better?
Well, Josh, oh, come on. In that case, I wouldn't even be around to complain about it, would I?
Well, exactly. You're making my point for me.
What point is that, Josh?
The point is, it's not your parents who owe you. It's you who owe them.
Oh, I owe them for what? Doing their duty as future parents?
It wasn't their duty, Ken. Look, deciding to have a child, making sacrifices for that future child even before it's conceived, these are acts of charity. It's like a gift. I mean, it's just, you're just making a mistake in thinking of our relations to people of the future in terms of duties.
Wait a minute. Suppose, just for supposition's sake, that we lay complete waste to this planet. Are you denying that people of the future would be within their rights to look back at us and say, look, past people, given that you despoiled our planet, why did you even bother bringing us into existence?
Well, then we say back to them, would you rather not exist?
Oh, and what if they said back to us, you know what, under these circumstances, we would rather not have existed. So we're suing you, past people. We're taking you to the court of intergenerational justice for wrongful existence.
So let me see if I have you right here, Ken. Now you're saying we might have an obligation not to bring future people into existence?
No. I'm saying we have an absolute duty to the future people not to ruin their future planet.
Even if you're right, there's a huge difference between leaving them a ruined planet and leaving one that's got, you know, a little wear and tear, a planet that's been lovingly used.
What are you talking, lovingly used? What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm trying to say is this. The real question comes down to how much we should sacrifice for the sake of future generations. I mean, should we live like monks so that they can live a life of plenty?
No, I wouldn't say that. No. That would imply that people of the future count more than us. I didn't say that, and I wouldn't say that.
Well, do they even count the same as us?
What, you think they count less than us?
Well, at least a little less. I mean, we have real, concrete, urgent interests. I mean, think of all the people starving right now across the globe. Whereas the interests of future people, they're, you know, abstract and hypothetical.
You know what? That's just the kind of attitude that explains our lack of action on things like climate change.
Oh, don't get me wrong. No, I'm all for combating climate change. Absolutely. I just don't think it's obvious how much weight we should give to the well-being of hypothetical future people as opposed to our own.
Well, okay, Josh, you know what? That's an interesting question, and I agree, and it's a challenging one. And to help us get started thinking about it, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to take a look at the history of our thinking about climate change and its impact on future generations. She files this report.
United Nations scientists say that we have 12 years left to avoid climate catastrophe. And even that would take a miracle. Celebrity naturalist David Attenborough pleaded for action during the recent UN climate summit in Poland.
If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon.
But in the run-up to the climate summit, President Donald Trump spoke with 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl.
I'm not denying climate change, but it could very well go back. You know, we're talking about over millions of years.
Some scientists say we're better off focusing on colonizing other planets to survive as a species. But author and journalist Nathaniel Rich says that 30 years ago, we had a real shot to save Earth for future generations.
Major progress was made to try to explain the problem to the public and then to formulate a solution, and yet we failed.
In a New York Times piece called Losing Earth, Rich attempts to understand why and how. The story starts in 1979. A political lobbyist named Rafe Pomerantz reads a report describing how the continued use of fossil fuels would bring about significant, damaging changes to the global atmosphere. So a terrified Pomerantz goes to alert Capitol Hill about the bad news.
Their first thought is that, well, surely if we explain the problem and what's at stake to the elders of government, then surely they will take action. They'll have no choice.
Instead, President Ronald Reagan comes in, opens up public land to mining and drilling. Then in 1985, there's a shift.
Ozone in the news. Satellite photos show that a hole opens in the ozone layer for a few months during Antarctica's springtime.
Lo and behold, the Reagan administration proposes a reduction in CFC emissions by 95%. Then comes 1988, the hottest and driest summer in U.S. history.
There was new science that had come forward that had shown that the problem was much greater than anyone had even feared. In the way that the ozone hole was being discussed, it certainly in the public eye, was the sky had ripped open and the sun was blazing through, and that we'd all get skin cancer and go blind. It was an image that people could visualize. It wasn't nearly as abstract. It was far more immediate. And the remedy was a lot easier.
And all this urgency seemed to help the cause, at least at first. By this point, climate change is considered nonpartisan. Even major oil companies have studied the problem and possible solutions, like in this video from Shell.
Global warming is not yet certain, but many think that to wait for final proof would be irresponsible. Action now is seen as the only safe insurance.
President George H.W. Bush declared, "Those who think we are powerless to do anything about the greenhouse effect, forget about the White House effect." 32 climate bills are introduced to Congress. Leaders around the world are poised to sign a global agreement to reduce greenhouse emissions. Until Bush's chief of staff convinces Washington that all this talk about global warming is bogus, and Washington doesn't push back.
I think we obsess over our present generation, our present well-being. I think we care deeply about the next generation. I think we care less deeply about two generations after that. And beyond that, I think we have very little interest.
And that, says Nathaniel Rich, was the beginning of the end.
The oil and gas industry had mobilized and started their decades-long propaganda effort, and the Republican Party had adopted as a kind of central tenet of Republicanism, climate denialism.
30 years later, Rich says, not much has changed, even as the current generation experiences the effects of a changing climate.
The line tends to be, see, now that climate change is at our doors, now that the flames are licking at our patio and the water is rising up the driveway, now surely you have to take this seriously.
There are millions and millions of people whose lives aren't in imminent danger. But he says, if we want to stop climate change, we need to push it as a moral issue.
Not simply we need to protect future generations, but because it is the ethical thing to do, because it is consistent with our deepest values and it is consistent with our highest view of ourselves.
Even if we do keep global warming down to 2 degrees, we still lose the world's tropical reefs, the sea level still rises several meters, and the Persian Gulf is still gone. And scientists say that's the best case scenario, a goal to push for. It's scientifically and technologically possible, but human nature will likely get in the way. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that tour of the history of climate change debates and in the context of thinking about intergenerational justice, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about what we owe to future generations.
We're joined now by Rahul Kumar, professor of philosophy at Queen's University and editor of Ethics and Future Generations. Rahul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Rahul, unfortunately, not many people devote all that much energy to worrying about the interest of future generations. You do, though. But I'm wondering, what first got you so gripped by this question that it led to a whole career of thinking about this?
Good question. When I was in high school, I used to read a lot of science fiction, both dystopian and some of it very hopeful. At the same time, I was surrounded by posters about the doomsday clock, and we would hear on the news about nuclear proliferation. So it seemed very vivid to me that, you know, we could simply end humanity at any time. And what a horrible thing it would be, because there are all these possibilities for the future, right? 500 years from now, I really wanted to believe that, you know, there would be life on Mars, thriving colonies, right? That we would live in an advanced civilization. And, you know, then I went to grad school and all of a sudden I was told, hey, these are actual philosophical questions, much to my, you know, amazement and delight. I could channel this sort of geeky interest into, you know, a career.
Yeah, that worked out well. I wanted to get your opinion on the question that Ken and I were debating about that, right? So we all, you know, I think we all agree that we care about future generations. But what makes you think that, or should we think that we have a duty to future generations as opposed to just, well, we care?
I think we absolutely have duties to future generations. Future generations are other people, like the people you're sitting beside. You have relationships with them. You have duties to them, whether or not you have relationships with them. I think intuitively, that's all you need to think. They're clearly obligations. You just have to think other people.
They're other people, but they're other hypothetical people.
They don't exist.
And Josh made this point. Well, which people they are depends on what we decide to do. And if my parents had decided not to have a kid when they did, I wouldn't exist. So what was their obligation to me? I mean, yeah, they're other possible people, but not other actual people. And we don't even have reciprocal relations to them.
I really don't think that kind of problem matters, right? So you don't need to know, right? If you're passing people on the street, you don't need to know much about the particular people there are, their identities. To know, you just have obligations to them. You know that, you know, if you're flying over, you know, a far-off country, you don't know anyone there. All you know is that there are people there. You think, well, maybe I won't drop a bunch of waste on their country, right? And, you know, kill people as the waste is falling from the airplane. So I think, you know.
Yeah, but those aren't the people in the other country. I don't know. They're not hypothetical people. They're not merely possible people. They're actual concrete people to whom I can do actual concrete harm. So look, if my parents hadn't given birth to me, would they have done an actual concrete harm to me?
No, they wouldn't. But the moment they decide to have you, I think they have obligations to us. And I think most of us want humanity to continue. We don't want it to end, right? And the moment we start thinking, well, we want humanity to continue, then I think we have obligations to sort of make sure that, you know, the people who live in the future have a certain kind of life available.
I kind of agree with that, but I still hear Josh probably would object, yes, but particular people, but that's a question we'll get into, okay?
Right.
So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking what we owe future generations with Rahul Kumar from Queen's University.
How do we balance the hypothetical interests of future people against our own interests, which are concrete? Should their interests count more, less, or about the same as ours?
It's a smackdown between the future people and the present people. How do we strike the balance? Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Decisions made today affect babies born tomorrow. So what do we owe them now? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're asking what we owe to future generations. Our guest is Rahul Kumar from Queen's University, editor of Ethics and Future Generations.
So, Rahul, I don't want to construe the competition between future and present generations as like a smackdown, but it has a little bit of a competitive thing, and you got to strike a balance. Here's a natural-seeming thought, maybe. Well, we should count all people's interests equally, whether they're past, present, or future. But you know what? Since the future people are going to eventually outnumber the total people around now, wouldn't that kind of balancing mean that we present people are, you know, we're always going to end up getting the short end of the stick? And that seems wrong.
I don't think we're going to get the short end of the stick. I do think we're going to have to make sacrifices to protect the interests of future people. But you know, the relationship between people now and people in the future isn't the same, right? What we can do for them is, you know, not undermine the prospects of them taking care of themselves and continuing to have a flourishing civilization. For people now, we can do a lot more. We can make bigger sacrifices to really directly improve the quality of life. So I don't think we stand in this sort of conflict of interest with them, right? Everyone counts the same, but we can do different things to protect their interests.
Wait a minute. So there's a lot of thought there. So I'm not quite sure if you agree or not disagree that it sounds like you're saying two things. One is their interests count equally to ours, but our opportunities to affect their difference versus the opportunities to affect the interests of people now are different. And it's a combination of like the weight of their interests combined with our opportunities. Did I hear you correctly?
That's absolutely right.
But I mean, because the worry for me would be if we think about this in terms of justice, you know, obviously, again, we agree that we have to care and we have to take action now. The question is, does it really look like justice? Because if you think about justice, the point of justice is impartial and everyone is treated equally. So if we were to treat future people equally to the way that treat people today, then, gosh, there are so many more of them than there are of us. It seems like we would have to basically starve ourselves to make it possible for them to have the equal treatment.
Yeah, I think that way of thinking things suggests that thinking about people impartially is just a matter of thinking how well or badly off are they, right? And then if we think that way, we think, well, there are going to be so many future people who we have to benefit, we have to starve ourselves. I think that's the wrong way to think about it, right?
Could you pause for a second? Because
sure.
I think you're right. That's the wrong way of thinking about it. But it sounds to me, I don't know if Josh has this in mind, like if I were a utilitarian, that's almost exactly how I would think about it, right? Every person counts equally. Just do the calculus of the greatest good for the greatest number. The future numbers are going to swamp the present numbers. So, I mean,
one way of thinking about this, and again, I'm advancing this just as an idea, not as something I myself believe. But, you know, you might imagine somebody saying population control, right? There's too many people on the planet right now. And so one thing we should be striving, you know, we should be limiting our own desire, for example, to make a certain number of babies, because that's going to increase the possibility for future generations to live a meaningful, choice-worthy life.
Yeah, but okay, there's a lot there. But I want you to tell me, was I thinking about it in utilitarian ways when I was thinking about that or not?
You were, and I think that utilitarian thinking leads us to sort of think our current lives are going to be swamped by the interests of future people. It's just another reason to reject utilitarian thinking about future generations, right? So much. I mean, I think there are many nails in that coffin. You know, my friends will disagree with me about this, but I think it's just the wrong way to conceive it. We shouldn't think of it ourselves as just in question how much good can we do. We should think about it as what kind of lives do we want, you know, our successors to have in 400 or 500 years, right? What kind, you know, opportunities do we want them to have? What do we want? Do we want them to carry on our projects, our civilizations? Do we want this? That should be the question.
So what do you think about that? I mean, because, you know, you might think on the one hand, well, we want them to have in a kind of abstract way the same opportunities as us. So we want them to be able to make similar kinds of choices. Or you might think there are some very specific things. Like, for example, we want Venice still to be around. We want everyone to continue to be able to enjoy Venice. So is it what we want the specific things we have now to be available? Or is it this kind of broader, we want them to live recognizably human lives where they can make meaningful choices and live in various parts of the planet? Which one is it?
I think both are true. I'll just give you an anecdote. When I was about 10 years old, you know, I got this picture book about ancient history out from the library. And, you know, one of the illustrations was about the great Library of Alexandria and its destruction. And it really upset me.
Me
I mean,
too.
When I think
it
about it now,
it
weighs
too.
On me. I think, how could they do that? We should have had that. I want Venice to continue. Yeah. You know, I want those, you know, I want Palmyra to continue. I want the great Buddha statues to continue.
Yes. But have you read The Man for All Seasons?
Yes.
We would all like to, I can't remember the exact line, we would all like something to be something, but it ain't.
We would like it, but, you know, we're in a position to make these choices, right? Unlike past generations, we know what we're doing. We know, you know, what the effects will be hundreds of years from now. So I think, you know, future generations can look back and say, not only did you do this, you knew what you were doing. You ignored our interests, right? You made sure we wouldn't have Venice. We wouldn't have the great art.
I get that. But there's one thing I want to say. Then let's get some callers in here. We got a whole lineup of them. But one thing I want to say is that I think there was lots of injustice done in the past. Lots and lots. I think the human world is a theater of moral imperfection and moral injustice. But I actually don't think that any of those past people, the people who sacked the burned the Library of Alexandria, I don't think they did an injustice to me. So, I mean, I might not like it, but do I have a complaint against them? Hey, look, you deprived me, right, of the good of the Library at Alexandria.
No, I think people then did not have the thought about, you know, the importance for this for people who will live in the far future. Our thinking has become much more cosmopolitan, both globally and temporally, right? Now it's perfectly available to us, right? What we will do if we destroy this, future generations won't have it. This is part of the reason we worry about climate change. We worried about what to do with nuclear waste. We worried about, well, you know, people in the far future are going to have to deal with this. What do we do?
So the trend of history is for away from normative circles built around kin, clan, and tribe to ever more encompassing circles of humanity and the global human community. And now you're saying it's the human community stretching forward and backwards in time that has become the locus of our moral concern.
I think that's absolutely true. I think most people feel this concern for the farther future. What holds them back is fear of what it might mean for their lives, right? Yeah. To what changes they will have to make to really address that concern.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what we owe to future generations. We'd love to have your thoughts on this. And Elizabeth from Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Elizabeth. What's your comment or question?
Good morning. So when I was in policy school, we had to try to figure out the future value that future generations would place on things. And people would say, you know, this is not a philosophy class, but how are we going to approach this? And so I did kind of come up with a way of thinking about it that has worked for me pretty well. And you might find it rather pat, but the notion is that if we can think of future generations as we think about potential guests in our home, that we, you know, you want to be prepared to receive them and have them feel comfortable and like they have appropriate options. But you don't make yourself crazy. You know, you don't deny yourself completely because, you know, you're preparing a place for both you and them to, you know, share in a way, but for them to experience. That seemed like the appropriate way to think about them. And that you can make the assumption that they will value at their core some of the basic things that we will value as well.
Well, that's
good. Beauty, comfort, and having choices. And that's worked for me.
That's good, Elizabeth. I want to ask you a really quick question. Does that mean they should think of us as the owner of the house, or should they think of us as only the temporary custodians of the house, which is equally theirs? Mm. I mean, to say they're guests is to say we have an asymmetric relationship to this earth.
Well, I mean, I think this is more for us in terms of, like, they are not our guests, but if we think of them with the same attitude that we do think of how we prepare for guests. That, like, that they, you know, like, not that they are going to be guests. This, they will be the custodians, you're right. But that in terms of what we, the way we think of how we prepare, the way we prepare for guests is kind of how we would prepare.
Okay, thanks a lot, Elizabeth. That was a great discussion. What do you think, Raul?
I think that's a great way to think about it, right? To think about, you know, what kind of home could we prepare such that they could be comfortable? And I would think of us as custodians. When she was talking, I was reminded, this is a bit cheesy, but I was reminded of watching Downton Abbey, right? And the way they would talk about the estate as, you know, just custodians of the estate, which they were passing on to future generations, right? And they had to keep it in good condition and working order so the people in the far future could also continue to enjoy. I think that's a good way to think about our position now, right?
I agree. And that's a really nice way of striking the balance. I mean, another metaphor that came to mind for me was the oxygen masks, you know, on the airplane. It always says, you know, put it on yourself first and then put it on other people. So it's a balance, right? There's a balance to be said. But it does bring up the question we were talking about earlier, one of the questions, which is, okay, let's leave aside, you know, hedonism. Let's leave aside people buying yachts and burning gas for fun. But let's talk about the devotion of resources to solving the world's pressing problems like hunger. How do we strike a balance between addressing problems of today and problems of tomorrow?
I think a lot of these things go hand in hand. And, you know, actual policy people, economics people can talk about this more precisely. But a lot of questions having to do with lifting people out of poverty have to do with trade and industrialization. Mm. And those questions raise questions about combating global warming, what kind of world is going to be for future generations, because we know they can't follow the same industrialization path we did. Right? That has led to the situation we're in. They need a different path, right? They need a different way to raise their standard of living. So I think this idea that, you know, well, either we help the global poor or we worry about future generations is a false dichotomy.
Well,
right? We have to worry about them both together.
I grant you that, but I don't think, speaking of policy people, especially economic policy people, I actually don't think they know how to think about this. I think they have a way of thinking about it, but they're a kind of utilitarian consequentialist, and it's going to get you lots of the wrong answers, I believe. So I actually think people like you, who reject utilitarian consequentialism, need to, like, engage people like them so that they put their policy frame on a different philosophical foundation. What do you think about that?
I think that's right, and I think philosophers are working hard to do that. Partly it becomes the responsibility for people like me to learn how to talk their language.
Right.
I don't think economists are really fundamentally are wedded to utilitarian or welfarist thinking. It's just the way people are taught in grad school.
They can
be nudged away from it if you really engage them.
Steve in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve. What's your comment or question?
This might sound a little harsh, but even by your guys' adult standards, I think...
Adult? Those are fighting words, Steve.
The point is that our obligation as a species is not to future generations of humans. It is to the rest of this ecosystem and planet. You know, we have a population of 7.5 billion and counting on an ecosystem that, by best estimates, can only cope with at most 2.5 billion of us. And our primary obligation at this point is to not reproduce. The simple fact of the matter is, this planet would be better off if our species didn't exist. And we need to face that adopt a little humility and actually start acting appropriately for the planet.
That is,
the whole discussion of what do we owe future generations of humans is unbelievably self-centered.
Okay, well, you could put it that way. So when I said to Josh in the beginning, you could decide not to have any more people, he backed off. He said he's not advocating human extinction. But you, Steve, sound like you are. And Raul, I want to know what you think about that. Should we be gradually winding down the human project?
No, I think it would be a great tragedy. I think we all think it would be horrible if the human project ended. We want it to continue. We look what we've accomplished in the past 1,000 years and think, wow, you know, given what we've done, imagine what we could do with, you know, 5 or 6,000 more years. But it's a respectable position to think it's really bad for the planet that the human species exists, right? I think that's something to be taken into account when we think about how the human species goes forward. But, you know, it goes very deep in all our psyche that we can't imagine, you know, the human project just ending.
Right. I mean, so maybe I take that point, but why not take seriously the idea of serious population control? So even if we don't go to the extreme of, well, yeah, you understand people saying it'd be better if human beings didn't exist, you take into account all of the other members of this ecosystem. But okay, if you stop short of that, why not say, let's have serious population control. Maybe we owe something to future generations, but we haven't decided how big those generations are going to be. Maybe we owe something to a future population of 2 billion, as Steve was saying.
Think about how draconian, though, that way of thinking will get quickly. Because then it's like, who's going to reproduce and who's going to have the right to reproduce? And we're going to change the whole human calculation of what a well-lived human life is to be like. So that's a really draconian thing, don't you think, Rahul?
Actually, I think there's not a real problem about population control. I think just, you know, the empirical evidence suggests the problem takes care of itself as people's standard of living rises, right? The problem is not going to be, you know, that there's going to be too many people. The problem is going to be making sure that, you know, humanity continues in sufficient numbers to sustain itself, right? To make sure we can continue, you know, the various kinds of, you know, aspects of humanity we cherish, not that there are too few people to maintain art and culture and science. Right?
I agree with you, but I think there is a problem about the distribution of the population around the globe, but that's a different issue, right?
That's absolutely a different issue, right. And that's part of the reason people think there's a big population problem. Yeah, I live in Canada. We could take a lot more people. There's
exactly.
A lot of empty space here.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about what we owe to future generations with Rahul Kumar from Queen's University.
What can we do now to safeguard the interests of future people? What should we do? And how can we convince people of the present to care about people of the future?
Sacrificing in the present in order to safeguard the future. When Philosophy Talk continues. Well, if the next generation think there's no future, why worry about what we might owe generations beyond them? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Rahul Kumar from Queen's University, and we're thinking about what we owe future generations.
And we've got a caller, John in Mountain View. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John. What's your comment or question?
Before I ask the question, surely you can find more horrible music than that. our future generations are not mythical, unimagined entities. If we have an environmental crisis with a 12-year horizon, as you stated at the beginning of the program, those future generations are already here.
Yeah.
For people with pregnant offspring, for example.
No, John, you've got a point. There are overlapping generations with us, and you might think, well, the question of intergenerational justice when it's about overlapping generations is one thing. But a lot of this discussion is about non-overlapping generations, because it's kind of easier to see that we might have generations to obligations to sort of actual people younger than us who are already here and to whom we're in some kind of relationship already. But I'll let Rahul, who's the authority, weigh in on whether I've got that right or not.
I agree. I think most people, you know, they find it easy to worry about their kids, their grandkids, maybe at a stretch, their great-grandkids. But when we worry about obligations to future generations, we're worried not about the effects of the next 12 years. We're worried about the effects 100 years from now, right? What if climate change leaves a situation where the remaining human population is just struggling for existence, right? That seems like the real catastrophe that we want to avoid.
And that worry means that we're going to have to impose cost, because justice is always about cost and benefits. We're going to have to impose cost on your about-to-be-born grandchild, too, right? So there are costs that we already have imposing your about-to-be-born grandchild, because they're going to have to pay into Social Security, and then whether they're going to get it or not, and there's a question of fairness. But then it's more. There's more costs that we're going to impose, not just for the old people around. So it's a complicated calculus, Ralph, don't you think? I mean, this whole calculus is extraordinarily complicated.
It is complicated. I tend to think it's less complicated for the children, the grandkids, than it is for us, because they will adapt into the world they inherit, right? So if they inherited a world where the expectation is, well, your lifestyle is more modest, your expectations, right, you pay more into Social Security and so on, they'll just take that for granted. That will just be the background against which they shape their plans. It's more alarming for us, because when we're used to our opulent lifestyle and we think, wow, we have to give all this up, we really have to revise our expectations, that can be disturbing and make people sort of shut down the question of obligations to future generations when they start thinking about it.
So we got a call from Al, who's in over there. I'm not quite sure where over there is. Is that where the Yanks are coming, kind of? Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Al.
Another way to call it evil. But anyway, just asking what thought this might be to any of you. Going the opposite of what Trump likes to call himself, the beauty of him is that he's greedy. Now, if you go in sort of my thought, the opposite way of that is sort of the notion of the Greeks, agape. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Agape makes a lot of
sense.
Sure. Yeah.
And trying to sort of overlord, if you will, to our younger generations, this idea of agape.
So thanks for that, Al. What do you think, Raul?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I think people feel this to a certain extent, that they have a certain thoughts about love, sort of inchoate thoughts about love of humanity, right? You know, when people go to museums, right, and see these, you know, ancient artifacts and things, you know, they feel great admiration and pride in what the human species has accomplished. You can teach the younger generation a certain feeling that, you know, what they are contributing to, right, is the continuity of the human project. And they can have feelings of love for that, to think, well, you know, this is really something deeply worth caring about and important to them, right? It's something bigger than themselves.
We'll start from the Library at Alexandria. And then we'll work out from there.
So, exactly.
So let's get specific, right? So we're gonna do something we sometimes do on the show. We're gonna make you czar for intergenerational justice, right? So you can do, you know, you can take any steps that you think are appropriate to get us present people to serve the cause of, you know, the future generation. So what's the single most consequential thing you think you'd do, you know, as your first act as czar?
Oh, I think everyone would say the same thing, is dramatically reduce carbon emissions, right? Just move us to the low carbon economy as quickly as possible. It will hurt, but, you know, we'll adjust.
So you think carbon tax? You think maybe expanding the solar grid? What's the way forward?
I'm a big carbon tax fan, and I actually talk about the carbon tax in courses I teach, which actually have nothing to do with future generations, just because I want people to understand that it's a very effective way of reducing carbon emissions.
Yeah.
Solar grids, right? You know,
I agree with all that, but I want to put something to you. One of the biggest carbon footprint things there is are airplanes and air travel. Okay, suppose we eliminated airplanes and air travel tomorrow, given that we don't have Star Trek transporter. The global economy, global commerce, international exchanges of all sorts would likely grind, I don't know if it'd grind to a halt, but it would slow down quite a lot. Some of these things that generate this pollution and all that, this assault on the earth, are at the core of our thriving in the world, of our living the lives that we live, and all these great achievements that we achieve. So what about that?
It would definitely mean less travel. I don't have this doom and gloom view about it. because I think we will. I think the technology will adapt. I think part of the reason it hasn't is that large companies don't actually think the population is really serious about reducing our carbon footprint. If they really thought people wanted this now and they were going to start changing their behavior to achieve that goal, the technology would evolve to make flights less a source of carbon emissions. I think probably fairly quickly. I'm an optimist, but look what's happened within our lifetimes. It's amazing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We got a caller on the line, Ariane from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ariane.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to comment that the planet is actually a living being, and we're actually engaged in massive genocide, which endangers the human species as well. And it's not enough to be talking about these things. We really have to come together as a society and find ways to actualize change. All these years we've been discussing and wrangling over whether climate change existed was part of the plan of the fossil fuel industries to basically continue to maximize their profits. And we're not doing enough or fast enough. And we have to come from another place within our heart, beyond our complacency. Yeah. Maitreya, a great teacher in London, says that America's greatest sin is our complacency. Okay. We have to find a way to be different.
Ariane, I think you've gone to something. And I want to put that to Raul in a certain way, because you kind of talked a little bit about our ever-evolving consciousness, the consciousness of the past generations versus our more cosmopolitan consciousness. But I wonder, in late 21st century capitalism, which shapes consciousness as much as any cultural force ever, are we ever going to get to Ariane's place?
I hope so.
How?
I hope so. This is not, it's a struggle, right? But the fact that, we worry about it as much as we do, even talk about the fossil fuel industry, the amount of work the fossil fuel industry has put in to make us worry about going to a low carbon economy, right, to make us fearful of it, shows that it's on our radar. We're thinking about it. We can see it happening. We're open to embracing it. It would help if the state itself were less involved in the propaganda and making us fearful of the possibility and encouraging us to think that we can do this, right? It won't be so bad.
I guess that's true. I also think about something that the philosopher Sam Scheffler said, that if we really realized how much it's in our own self-interest to leave a world to future generations that's recognizably like our own, that might change people's minds. Yeah. Because it's one thing to say, well, you have an obligation. I prefer Elizabeth's way of thinking about it. We should think about it as, a kind of kindness to future possible guests. But how much more powerful to say, you know what you're doing if you're letting the world grind itself down to nothing, or at least to a human nothing? You're making all of your projects meaningless.
Exactly.
Everything you're doing right now
is
meaningless unless there's a human population in the future that lives lives that we can understand.
What do you think of that, Ro?
I think that's powerful, and I think Sam's argument is exactly right. And it shows not just that it's in our self-interest, but it's in our interest because we already care, right? It shows that our concern extends way beyond ourselves, right? We want our projects to continue into the future. We want people to care about the same kinds of things we're caring about. And the thought that it will just be all over is terrifying to people.
Yeah, I get you. I totally agree with both of you. But there is this thing. I do think there's another countervailing force in our time. We are deeply presentist. Mm-hmm. We think the past is a desert of moral error and this, that, and the other thing. And we do think a bit about the future, but we think about the future in terms of protecting us. So I think there is an ethos of presentism in our way that gets deeply in our way.
Absolutely.
I think there is that ethos of presentism gets in our way, but I think part of the ethos is just driven by fear, right? That there's an underlying awareness of the challenges the future presents us, and we tend to hide from it. We tend to think, it's so overwhelming, right? We think about global poverty, we think about future generations, we think about environmental concerns, and we think, can't deal with it. Just going to focus on the here and now. That's the thing we have to get past, the thought that this is something we cannot cope with, we can't do.
On that wise note, Raul, I'm going to say that future generations will thank us for having had you on this program someday. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a lot of fun.
Our guest has been Raul Kumar, who is professor of philosophy at Queen's University, editor of Ethics and Future Generations. So, Josh, you got one last brief thought for us?
Listen, I think you guys are a little too sanguine about population. I'm not saying don't have any kids, but maybe instead of three, have two. Instead of eating meat 7 days a week, eat it 3 days a week.
Yeah, we did an episode on one child too many that says one is too many. So the population issue is a big issue. I do think we have to think about that. But I am not for the extinction of the species.
And neither am I.
The conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. It's apologies to Descartes. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, what do we owe to fast-talking futurists? Let's ask Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, one of the weird things we do is tar an entire group of people with a sticky brush just because their birthdays clump together. It probably began with the invention of the teenager in the mid-50s. Not sure before that we had the Bobby socks, but once Frank Sinatra got a little meat in his bones and started singing show tunes in Vegas, we thought we'd all get back to normal. But then the 50s came along. TV turned everybody into customer and product both, while the adults wolfed down tranquilizers and martinis waiting for the bubble to burst. And the generation born in the period just after World War II, known as the Baby Boom, came to be known as the Boomers. They grew up in the biggest burst of prosperity for the biggest number of people the world has ever seen, and it came to pass the Boomers ruined everything. We like being called Boomers for one thing, so we made up names for the generations to follow, Gen X, Gen Y, Millennials, and they all hate Boomers. Boomers hate Boomers. There's so many. Even if you start to die off, some try to hate the Millennials more, but it's hard. Those are our kids. They can't be worse than we are. We worked hard for that entitlement. We'd have to give back all the memoirs and rehab stints and tell-alls. Who would have them? Boomers ruined everything. We made rock and roll a thing and then paid too much attention to it and made everybody sick of it. We made the Beatles so famous they had to quit. It was too weird. We made the records smaller and smaller until they disappeared. We made the movies smaller and smaller until they disappeared, except for blockbusters, which we invented, thus ruining movies for everybody. Except for Obama, all our boomer leaders have been sleazy. Our current leader, President Trump, wears his sleaze like a crown of thorns, which is purchased at Walmart, all thorns removed. We're supposed to admire Steve Jobs. Can't do it. I've tried. Every time I watch a video on my iPhone, I lift my eyes to heaven. But I know he's not there, and then my screen freezes, and I throw the phone across the room. It's a sucker's game. And we are the kings and queens of suckers. The Nigerian scam was developed for fools such as we. In politics, we started with Korea, moved on to Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. We've won nothing. We even blew winning the Cold War. We made a hot mess of things. Not only was Alderman Ruth not tried for treason, he was made head of the National Rifle Association. Boomers turned the NRA from a gun safety organization into everybody buy guns all the time or the terrorists win kind of boys club. We keep cutting our own taxes and don't want to pay for anything except Hamilton tickets or basketball playoffs. We put a new spin on self-righteousness. You can't talk to us about anything. We were the kings of smoking and then the kings of scoldy non-smokers. We're the queens of self-indulgence, so we became mommies and then we child-proofed everything in sight. We love drugs until we are drug-free. We gave the world disco music. We embraced the concept of woke. Millennials may have killed JCPenney, but boomers did in Woolworths. Downtown has never been the same. That's just the tip of the iceberg, which is melting because we're horrible stewards of the planet. Even discussing what we owe to generations not yet born is such a boomer thing. God forbid we pay taxes for infrastructure. We're taking it with us. That's all there is to it. And it's a good thing millennials like selfie sticks if you make them biodegradable, which you should. It's about all that we left to eat. That's my final advice. And all you're getting from me, I didn't get my jetpack. You live with it, YouTubers. Make a podcast about it, millennials. That's like radio, only lazy. Do that job in your pajamas. Boomers wish they'd thought of that. Thanks to the efforts of Ralph Lauren, though, we did make the polo shirt a fashion superstar. Millennials, you gave the world avocado toast and the bespoke hoodie. Take that pride to the grave. Follow our lead, then give your children nothing. And we'll see you in heaven, which boomers will have acquired in a leveraged buyout. So you be at the pearly gates with cash in hand. You snooze, my friend, you lose. Enough said. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pamantwan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler,
Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
In the last 6 years, we have been able to stop global warming. Glaciers that once were melting are now on the attack. As you know, these renegade glaciers have already captured parts of Upper Michigan and Northern Maine, but I assure you, we will not let the glaciers win.